Europe and the Faith by Hilaire Belloc. Part 2 of Chapter 9, The Defection of Britain. Nevertheless, even with such allies, barbarism would have failed, the Reformation would today be but a historical episode without fruit. Europe would still be Christendom, had not there been added the decisive factor of all, which was the separation of Britain. Now, how did Britain go, and why was the loss of Britain of such capital importance? The loss of Britain was of such capital importance because Britain alone, of those who departed, was Roman, and therefore capable of endurance and increase. And why did Britain fail in that great ordeal? It is a question harder to answer. The province of Britain was not a very great one, in area or in numbers, when the Reformation broke out. It was indeed very wealthy for its size, as were the Netherlands, but its mere wealth does not account for the fundamental importance of the loss of Britain to the faith in the 16th century. The real point was that one and only one of the old Roman provinces, with their tradition of civilization, letters, persuasive power, multiple soul, one and only one went over to the barbaric enemy and gave that enemy its aid. That one was Britain. And the consequence of its defection was the perpetuation and extension of an increasingly evil division within the structure of the West. To say that Britain lost hold of tradition in the 16th century because Britain is Teutonic is to talk nonsense. It is to explain a real problem by inventing unreal words. Britain is not Teutonic, nor does the word Teutonic itself mean anything definite. To say that Britain revolted because the seeds of revolt were stronger in her than in any ancient province of Europe is to know nothing of history. The seeds of revolt were in her then, as they were in every other community, as they must be in every individual who may find any form of discipline a burden, which he is tempted in a moment of disorder to lay down. But to pretend that England and the lowlands of Scotland, to pretend that the province of Britain in our general civilization was more ready for the change than the infected portions of southern Gaul, or the humming towns of northern Italy, or the intense life of Hainaut or Brabant, is to show great ignorance of the European past. Well then, how did Britain break away? I beg the reader to pay a special attention to the next page or so. I believe it to be of capital value in explaining the general history of Europe, and I know it to be hardly ever told, or, if told at all, told only in fragments. England went because of three things. First, her squires had already become too powerful. In other words, the economic power of a small class of wealthy men had grown, on account of peculiar insular conditions, greater than was healthy for the community. Secondly, England was, more than any other part of Western Europe, save the Batavian March, footnote, I mean Belgium, that frontier of Roman influence upon the Lower Rhine, which so happily held out for the faith and just preserved it. A series of markets and ports, a place of very active cosmopolitan influence, in which new opportunities for the corrupt, new messages for the enthusiastic, were frequent. In the third place, that curious phenomena on which I dwelt in the last chapter, the superstitious attachment of citizens to the civil power, to awe of and devotion to the monarch, was exaggerated in England as nowhere else. Now, put these three things together, especially the first and third, for the second was both of minor importance and more superficial. And you will appreciate why England fell. One small, too wealthy class, tainted with the atheism that always creeps into wealth long and securely enjoyed, was beginning to possess too much of English land. It would take far too long to describe here what the process had been. It is true that the absolute monopoly of the soil, the gripping and strangling of the population by landlords, is a purely Protestant development. Nothing of that kind had happened or would have been conceived of as possible in pre-Reformation England. But still, something like a quarter of the land, or a little less, had already, before the Reformation, got into the full possession of one small class, which had also begun to encroach upon the judiciary, in some measure to supplant the populace in local lawmaking, and quite appreciably to supplant the king in central lawmaking. Let me not be misunderstood. The England of the 15th century, the England of the generation just before the Reformation, was not an England of squires. It was not an England of landlords. It was still an England of Englishmen. The towns were quite free. To this day, old boroughs nearly always show a great number of freeholds. The process by which the later English aristocracy, now a plutocracy, had grown up was but in germ before the Reformation. Nor had that germ sprouted. But for the Reformation, it would not have matured. Sooner or later, a popular revolt, had the faith revived, would have killed the growing usurpation of the wealthy. But the germ was there, and the Reformation coming just as it did, both was helped by the rich and helped them. The slow acquisition of considerable power over the courts of law and over the soil of the country by an oligarchy, imperfect though that acquisition was as yet, already presented, just after 1500, a predisposing condition to the disease. It may be urged that if the English people had fought the growing power of the squires more vigorously, the squires would not have mastered them as they did, during and on account of the religious revolution. Possibly. And the enemies of the English people are quick to suggest that some native sluggishness permitted the gradual weighing down of the social balance in favor of the rich. But no one who can even pretend to know medieval England will say that the English consciously desired or willingly permitted such a state of affairs to grow up. Successful foreign wars, dynastic trouble, a recent and vigorous awakening of national consciousness, which consciousness had centered in the wealthier classes, all these combined to let the evil in without warning, and, on the eve of the Reformation, a rich, avaricious class was already empowered to act in Britain, ready to grasp, as all the avaricious classes were throughout the Western world, at the opportunity to revolt against that faith which has ever suspected, constrained, and reformed the tyranny of wealth. Now, add to this the strange, but at that time very real, worship of government as a fetish. This spirit did not really strengthen government. Far from it. A superstition never strengthens its object, nor even makes of the supposed power of that object a reality. But though it did not give real power to the long intention of the prince, it gave to the momentary word of the prince a fantastic power. In such a combination of circumstances, nascent oligarchy, but the prince worshipped, you get, holding the position of prince, Henry VIII, a thorough tutor. That is, a man weak almost to the point of irresponsibility where his passions were concerned. Violent from that fundamental weakness which, in the absence of opposition, ruins things as effectively as any strength. No executive power in Europe was less in sympathy with the revolt against civilization than was the Tudor family. Upon the contrary, Henry VII, his son, and his two granddaughters, if anything, exceeded in their passion for the old order of the Western world. But at the least sign of resistance, Mary who burnt, Elizabeth who intrigued, Henry their father who pillaged, Henry their grandfather who robbed and saved, were one. To their characters, slight resistance was a spur. With strong manifold opposition, they were quite powerless to deal. Their minds did not grip, for their minds, though acute, were not large. But their passions shot. And one may compare them when their passions of pride, of lust, of jealousy, of doting, of avarice, or of facile power were aroused to vehement children. Never was there a ruling family less statesmanlike, never one less full of stuff and of creative power. Henry, urged by an imperious young woman who had gained control of him, desired a divorce from his wife Catherine of Aragon, grown old for him. The papal court temporized with him and opposed him. He was incapable of negotiation, and still more incapable of foresight. His energy, which was of an Arabian sort, blasted through the void because a void was there. None would then withstand the prince. Of course, it seemed to him no more than one of these recurrent quarrels with the mundane power of Rome, which all kings, and saints among them, had engaged in for many hundred years. All real powers thus conflict in all times. But had he known it, and he did not know it, the moment was fatally inopportune for playing such a game. Henry never meant to break permanently with the unity of Christendom. A disruption of that unity was probably inconceivable to him. He meant to exercise pressure. All his acts, from the decisive proclamation of September 19, 1530, onwards, prove it. But the moment was the moment of a breaking point throughout Europe, and he, Henry, blundered into disaster without knowing what the fullness of that moment was. He was devout, especially to the Blessed Sacrament. He kept the faith for himself, and he tried hard to keep it for others. But having lost unity, he let in what he loathed. Not so long as he lived could those doctrines of the reformers triumph here. But he had compromised with their spirit, and at his death a strong minority, perhaps a tenth of England, more of London, was already hostile to the creed. It was the same thing with the suppression of the monasteries. Henry meant no effect on religion by that loot. He nonetheless destroyed it. He intended to enrich the crown. He ruined it. In the matter of their financial endowment, an economic crisis produced by the unequal growth of economic powers had made the monastic foundation ripe for resettlement. Religious orders were here wealthy without reason, poor in spirit and numbers, but rich in land. There, impoverished without reason, rich in popularity and spiritual power, but poor in land. The dislocation which all institutions necessarily suffer on the economic side through the mere efflux of time, inclined every government in Europe to a resettlement of religious endowment. Everywhere it took place. Everywhere it involved dissolution and restoration. But Henry did not resettle. He plundered and broke. He used the contemporary idolatry of executive power just as much at Reading or in the Black Friars of London, where unthinking and immediate popular feeling was with him, as at Glastonbury, where it was against him, as in Yorkshire, where it was in arms, as in Galway, where there was no bearing with it at all. There was no largeness in him, nor any comprehension of complexity. And when in this Jacobin, unexampled way, he had simply got rid of that which he should have restored and transformed, of what effect was that vast act of spoliation? It paralyzed the church. It ultimately brought down the monarchy. From a fourth to the third of the economic power over the means of production in England, which had been vested top heavily in the religious foundations, here far too rich, there far too poor, Henry got, by one enormous confiscation, yet he made no permanent addition to the wealth of the crown. On the contrary, he started its decline. The land passed by an instinctive multiple process, but very rapidly, to the already powerful class which had begun to dominate the villages. Then, when it was too late, the Tudors attempted to stem the tide, but the thing was done. Upon the indifference which is always common to a society long and profoundly Catholic and ignorant of heresy, or, having conquered heresy, ignorant, at any rate, of struggle for the faith, two ardent minorities converged. The small minority of confused enthusiasts who really did desire what they believed to be a restoration of primitive Christianity. The much larger minority of men now grown almost invincibly powerful in the economic sphere. The squires, 20 years after Henry's death, had come to possess, through the ruin of religion, something like half the land of England. With the rapidity of a fungus growth, the new wealth spread over the desolation of the land. The enriched captured both the universities, all the courts of justice, most of the public schools. They won their great civil war against the crown. Within a century after Henry's folly, they had established themselves in the place of what had once been the monarchy and central government of England. The impoverished crown resisted in vain. They killed one embarrassed king, Charles I, and they set up his son, Charles II, as an insufficiently salaried puppet. Since their victory over the crown, they and the capitalists who have sprung from their avarice and their philosophy, and largely from their very loins, have been completely masters of England. Here the reader may say, "What? This large national movement to be interpreted as the work of such minorities? A few thousand squires and merchants backing a few more thousand enthusiasts changed utterly the mass of England?" Yes. To interpret it otherwise is to read history backwards. It is to think that England then was what England later became. There is no more fatal fault in the reading of history, nor any illusion to which the human mind is more prone. To read the remote past in the light of the recent past, to think the process of one towards the other, inevitable. To regard the whole matter as a slow, inexorable process, independent of the human will, still suits the materialist pantheism of our time. There is an inherent tendency in all men to this fallacy of reading themselves into the past, and of thinking their own mood a consummation at once excellent and necessary. And most men who write of these things imagine a vaguely Protestant Tudor England growing consciously Protestant in the England of the Stuarts. That is not history. It is history to put yourself, by a combined effort of reading and of imagination, into the shoes of Tuesday, as though you did not know what Wednesday was to be, and then to describe what Tuesday was. England did not lose the faith in 1550 to 1620 because she was Protestant then. Rather, she is Protestant now because she lost the faith. Put yourselves into the shoes of a 16th century Englishman in the midst of the Reformation, and what do you perceive? A society wholly Catholic in tradition, lax and careless in Catholic practice, irritated or enlivened here and there by a few furious preachers, or by a few enthusiastic scholars, at once devoted to and in terror of the civil government. Intensely national. In all the roots and traditions of its civilization, Roman. Impatient of the disproportion of society, and in particular of economic disproportion in the religious aspect of society, because the religious function, by the very definition of Catholicism, by its very creed, should be the first to redress tyrannies. Upon that Englishman comes first a mania for his king, next a violent economic revolution, which in many parts can be made to seem an approach to justice. Finally, a national appeal of the strongest kind against the encroaching power of Spain. When the work was done, say by 1620, the communication between England and those parts of the ancient West which were still furiously resisting the storm was cut. No spiritual force could move England after the Armada, and its effect, save what might arise spontaneously in the many excited men who still believed, they had continued to believe it for 50 years, that the whole Church of Christ had gone wrong for centuries, that its original could be restored, and that personal revelations were granted them for their guidance. These visionaries were the reformers. To these, souls still athirst for spiritual guidance turned. They were a minority even at the end of the 16th century, the last years of Elizabeth, but they were a minority full of initiative and of action. With the turn of the century, 1600 to 1620, the last men who could remember Catholic training were very old or dead. The new generation could turn to nothing but the new spirit. For authority, it could find nothing definite but a printed book, a translation of the Hebrew scriptures. For teachers, nothing but this minority, the reformers. That minority, though remaining a minority, leavened and at last controlled the whole nation. By the first third of the 17th century, Britain was utterly cut off from the unity of Christendom, and its new character was sealed. The Catholic faith was dead. The governing class remained largely indifferent, as it still is, to religion. Yet it remained highly cultured. The populace drifted here into complete indifference, there into orgiastic forms of worship. The middle class went over in a solid body to the enemy. The barbarism of the outer Germanies permeated it and transformed it. The closer reasoned, far more perverted and harder French heresy of Calvin partly deflected the current. and a whole new society was formed and launched. That was the English Reformation. Its effect upon Europe was stupendous, for though England was cut off, England was still England. You could not destroy in a Roman province the great traditions of municipality and letters. It was as though a phalanx of trained troops had crossed the frontier in some border war and turned against their former comrades. England lent, and has from that day continuously lent, the strength of a great civilized tradition to forces whose original initiative was directed against European civilization and its tradition. The loss of Britain was the one great wound in the body of the Western world. It is not yet healed. Yet all this while, that other island of the group to the northwest of Europe, that island which had never been conquered by armed civilization, as were the outer Germanies, but had spontaneously accepted the faith, presented a contrasting exception. Against the loss of Britain, which had been a Roman province, the faith, when the smoke of battle cleared off, could discover the astonishing loyalty of Ireland. And over against this exceptional province, Britain, now lost to the faith, lay an equally exceptional and unique outer part which had never been a Roman province, yet which now remained true to the tradition of Roman men. It balanced the map like a counterweight. The efforts to destroy the faith in Ireland have exceeded in violence, persistence, and cruelty any persecution in any part or time of the world. They have failed. As I cannot explain why they have failed, so I shall not attempt to explain how and why the faith in Ireland was saved when the faith in Britain went under. I do not believe it capable of a historical explanation. It seems to me a phenomenon essentially miraculous in character, not generally attached, as are all historical phenomena, to the general and divine purpose that governs our large political events, but directly and specially attached. It is of great significance. How great, men will be able to see many years hence, when another definite battle is joined between the forces of the Church and her opponents. For the Irish race, alone of all Europe, has maintained a perfect integrity and has kept serene. Without internal reactions and without their consequent disturbances, the soul of Europe, which is the Catholic Church. I have now nothing left to set down but the conclusion of this disaster, its spiritual result, an isolation of the soul, its political result, a consequence of the spiritual, the prodigious release of energy, the consequent advance of special knowledge, the domination of the few under a competition left unrestrained, the subjection of the many, the ruin of happiness, the final threat of chaos. End of chapter 9.